Dr. Smith, please call down to surgery. Dr. Smith, please report to surgery. Outside the closed door of the hospital room, the brigadier paused to speak to the detective inspector assigned to the case.
Where's the husband now?
The man nodded towards the elevators.
Up about 3 floors, Gov. Under watch.
What? Hospitalized?
Dying of leukemia.
The man flipped open his memo book to double check.
Yeah, that's what it is. Leukemia. Final stages. So I'm told. We're not far from it. That's how the wife escaped him. His strength is low.
She was caring for him.
Unaccountable. Just unaccountable. Married 35 years.
The brigadier shot a glance at the closed door of the hospital room.
Is she able to talk to us?
The detective nodded.
Go on in. She's not very bad off. Just shocked. She's mostly worried for him.
Doctor.
They knocked and entered. A woman in her very early 60s was propped up on pillows in bed. Her steel gray hair was done in one of those styles from a professional salon. There was a middle-class, respectable, solid look about her, as well as a certain faded attractiveness.
Come in, Captain. Come in. Do you have any word on my husband, Jack?
I'll be happy to check on that for you, madam.
It was the medication. It had to be the medication, Captain. He would never do that otherwise. Jack's as mild as milk.
I'm inclined to agree with you, madam, but...
She interrupted him by handing him a slip of paper. He glanced at it and passed it to the doctor.
That's the list of his medications. I wrote it up just now. You, sir, doctor, couldn't they interact with each other? I mean, in a bad way?
Perhaps. He's taking all this at once?
Oh, different doses at different times, but yes... He had his chemotherapy and then suffered several infections. A bit of pneumonia that I really thought might do him in. But he came back from it. It's the nausea that brings him so low now. We just started a new drug for that. And then he just swears by these vitamins I get for free at the clinic.
Clinic?
Well, we've spent a good bit on his medical care. There are several expenses, you know, that have to be borne. I thought it best to watch out for myself. We can't both be down at once. I get the vitamins at the nutritional clinic near our house. It's a private organization, but it's run by medical doctors.
But your husband takes the vitamins as well.
Yes, we can't tell if they've done him any good or not. What do you think? Did the drugs do something to him?
The doctor looked carefully at the list.
There are so many here, Mrs. Harding, it's difficult to say. It might just be possible.
Did he start on any of these just recently?
Well, he's been taking the vitamins all along, but I just picked up a new bottle yesterday. And the nausea medicine. It's a new drug he's trying.
Nausea from the chemotherapy? I thought he had finished the chemotherapy.
She nodded and raised a hand to her bruised throat, fingering the sensitive skin there, called away from their presence for a moment.
Oh, do forgive me. Yes, Captain, it's an after effect. They said it could last for several weeks. You see, the chemotherapy wasn't really bothering his stomach at all, not directly. It inflames a tiny nerve center at the base of the brain that triggers the nausea and vomiting. So the specialist found him this new medicine. It blocks those nerve cells from reacting as much. Done him a world of good. He only started taking it yesterday, but he could keep food in his stomach almost right off.
When he attacked you, you fought him off?
I did, Doctor. Not mean and hard. He was crying like... A little like a sleepwalker, maybe.
Crying?
Well, he came at me, his face all red. He was jabbering a bit, saying he was hot. Then he started to be angry because I was moving about the kitchen, cleaning up from breakfast. I didn't know what had gotten into him, but his face was so livid red that he looked like he was out of his mind. I was somewhat ready when he came at me. I was sure it was the medicine doing it, a bad pill or something.
He did grab you round the throat.
She took her hand away from her throat to show him.
But he could hardly stay on his feet. I got my hand on the tea kettle and hit him on the side of the head with it. It burned his scalp a bit because it was still warm. It seemed to clear him up for a bit. He started screaming for me to get away, to get out of there. Then he commenced to smashing up the dishes and glasses as though something had hold of him and he just had to break things. I ran out to call the police and he came after me. I locked him out of the bedroom and got to the phone. But little Jack, who never so much as swatted the dog with the paper, finally broke down the door. By then he was clean out of his mind. He got me again, round the throat, but I kept pulling away as he got weaker. Just as my own legs were going out from under me, the police came.
What a horrible experience.
She looked at them both, suddenly alone and vulnerable and worried.
But once it wears off, he'll be terribly worried and frightened, sirs. When may I see him? They haven't taken him to jail, have they? I know it wasn't really him doing it.
When Joe came around again, she had a blurred impression of men scrabbling or fighting in a corner. She heard the scuffle much more clearly than she saw it, the groans and cries of George Callie, as the constable, cursing profusely at him, wrestled him into submission and put restraints on him. Strong arms got under her shoulders. She saw a woman's face, and then a man's face alongside it. Both of them were asking her questions.
"He stopped!"
She tried to tell them not to hurt him, but she could not make her words come out. The strongest impression that she had was that the constable was even more frightened and horrified than she was, and was giving vent to it by restraining Callie with more than necessary force. She wanted to tell him not to hurt Callie, that Callie had stopped choking her before the door had crashed open, but her head swam, and it was still hard to get her breath. When she came around again, she was in a sort of infirmary, and a gray-haired, serious-looking man with a white jacket on over his suit was peering at her and taking her pulse.
"Can you hear me, miss?"
She nodded.
"Does it hurt here?"
His finger touched her throat. Her hand whipped out and knocked his hand away. Even she was startled by this. He did not try to touch her throat again.
"All right, all right. I don't think there's any damage done to you, just bruising."
He hesitated and then patted her arm.
"I'll be checking on you every 5 minutes. You need to stay very still for a half hour or so."
She lay very still. She wanted to be still. Her throat felt bruised and sore in a way it had never felt before, as though muscles and skin she'd never known she had were now inflamed and angry. There was a tightness in her chest, and she could not determine if it was there from the attack or because she was still so frightened. She did not think anybody could sleep after such a close brush with death, but she fell almost instantly asleep. What woke her was a low voice speaking with great irritation to somebody else.
"All right, Sergeant. See to him, then. And this time, try not to make such a blasted hash of things. It's enough we've got them murdered in the streets. We don't need it right here."
She opened her eyes. A slightly scruffy-looking man in a rather cheap suit with a wide blue tie was bringing in a tray of mugs and packets of sugar. He set it down on a table against one wall and then pulled up a chair alongside her. He had an untidy mustache and furry gray and brown eyebrows, but his eyes were soft and dark. Indeed, in spite of his scruffiness and the harsh words he had just given to somebody, she instantly liked him. He smiled back at her.
"Miss Grant, I'm Chief Inspector Jules. I brought you some good strong tea."
He helped her to sit up, then made the tea. He emptied several packets of sugar into one of the mugs, looked around for a spoon, and then stirred the tea with his pen and brought it to her. The hot, sweet tea helped wash away some of the soreness at the base of her throat. He sat down with his own mug and let her drink. When about half of her tea was gone, he spoke.
"I understand that George Callie attacked you in his cell."
"He stopped. He stopped before he had finished."
"Are you saying that because you pity him, Miss Grant?"
The detective's eyes showed both doubt and a certain new respect for her.
"I do pity him, but I'm telling you the truth."
"He killed his wife, you know."
She nodded. It was difficult to talk. Using the muscles in her throat was painful. She took another huge swallow of tea, and he stood up and found a teapot so that he could make more.
"We owe you an apology. I owe you an apology. It was madness and negligence to leave you alone with him."
"I wanted to be alone with him. The constable offered to take us to an interview room and stay there, but I said no."
He plugged the tea kettle in again and then sat down in the hard chair.
He looked at her with his doe-like eyes from under the frowsy, grizzled eyebrows.
"So why do you think he attacked you?"
"I think he's trying to prove to himself that he's a killer. He's trying to force himself to believe it's his fault he killed his wife."
"Do you think he's gone mad?"
She hesitated and then nodded. Detective Jules spoke to her for another 30 minutes, and she had two more steaming mugs of the very sweet tea. Their conversation was no more than a polite attempt to give her a chance to collect herself, but he was relaxed and pleasant to talk to. There was something comforting about him, a sort of determination to see to her in an offhand, friendly way. At last she was ready to leave.
"One of our people can drive you home."
"I'm fine, really."
He nodded and let her go. Her legs were steady as she left the building and found her car. But as soon as she climbed into the front seat, she saw that she was not fine. One look at the rearview mirror showed her that the side of her face was bruised and swollen from hitting the floor, and there were distinct finger marks bruised into the fragile flesh of her throat. She had seen the photographs of the murdered women, and now she looked just like them, except she was alive. Her own eyes, still showing fear and stress, were the only difference. The doctor strode into the lab.
"Joe, I've got some prescriptions to be filled."
He glanced around, saw her jacket hung up in the corner, and strode around the lab looking for some other sign of her.
"Joe?"
The storeroom door was open.
"You didn't get that frequency generator, did you?"
He poked his head inside the tiny room. She stood at the back where the light was dim, her hand resting on one of the shelves, a picture of uncertainty.
"You've changed your clothes."
As she did not answer, he became concerned.
"Joe?"
"I didn't mind so much until now."
He strode into the room.
"Maybe you'd better not."
"Whatever is the matter?"
He came and stood in front of her, looked down at her, and it took him a moment to realize that what he had taken for shadow on the side of her face was not shadow. It reduced his voice to a whisper.
"Joe, I'm all right, really."
But tears suddenly spilled down her cheeks. The brave front of professionalism could not be maintained forever.
"Who did this? How did this happen?"
He quickly gathered her to himself, gentle and concerned as he could be whenever he chose. He was still wearing his cape, and he moved it over his shoulder so that it was draped over her as well, heavy and comforting, closing her in.
"Tell me who did this."
His voice, still a whisper, was almost frightened. His big hands, suddenly authoritative, gentle, and skillful, traversed over her head and face, checking for more injury. She realized that he feared something far more invasive and degrading than what had actually been done to her. But to her own surprise, she couldn't answer him. His concern made her cry even more than she had expected. His alert mind began putting together some clues: her mission for the day, the bruising on her face, the strained quality of her voice. She had changed into a pullover with a cowl neck. He looked down at her, touched the fabric at her throat, and as she did not resist, he used two fingers to pull the cowling to the side. He looked at the bruising on her throat, and she looked away. He removed his fingers from the cowling.
"Tell me who?"
She made herself answer him.
"One of the men has gone mad. He wanted to believe he could kill. He tried to kill me, but he couldn't make himself do it."
She suddenly shivered with an uncontrollable shiver. Her life had lain in the narrow margin between Callie's insanity and the last vestiges of empathy that had remained to him.
"I should never have sent you off to them alone."
"Yes, you should. I could have had a guard. I didn't want one. It really was brief. He tried to strangle me, but he stopped himself."
"All right, all right."
He pulled her in and stroked the hair on the very top of her head, silent until she was calm again.
"Doctor."
"What's that?"
"We have to decide who these crimes are against."
He looked down at her.
"What?"
She pulled away enough to look up at him.
"Is it to kill women? Or is it to destroy men? Is somebody trying to destroy these men by making them kill women?" "Two of the men were at the Women's Health Center. Both of them there the same day they killed their victims. It was the first two men we talked to."
"And the others?"
"No. I've been back here for nearly an hour and checked, and it doesn't seem that the others ever came near the place.
but it may be worth checking further. Both Bilkins and McClellan were sent into a private waiting room off the main waiting room. Calmer now, he smoothed back her hair from her face, and his analytical eyes, she knew, were looking at her black eye and scraped cheekbone, measuring them up to see how she had hit the floor, how hard, how many times. Private consultation rooms are not unusual, Joe.
For a bladder infection.
We'll check it tomorrow, all right? He let her go, but kept his eyes fixed on her, grave and concerned. She squeezed his hand and offered him a faint smile.
I'm all right. Did I hear you say there are prescriptions to check?
Yes. He fished in his pocket and brought out a list.
We'll need samples of all of these and a history of where they came from.
She looked up, hopeful of a third tie-in, but he shook his head.
Not the Women's Health Center, I'm afraid. One of our suspects is in the final stages of leukemia. He was seeing several doctors, but entirely at hospitals and clinics.
I made a good contact with an Inspector Jules. I want to follow up with him on some questions.
Doctor? Doctor?
Jo steeled herself to go out and be looked at. The worst part about walking around with a black eye was the notoriety. The doctor took her hand and walked out with her.
What now?
The doctor let Joe stay back by the shelving outside the storage closet door. He came forward. The brigadier had a clear plastic bag in his hand.
Is Miss Grant all right? I just got a call, patched through, from an Inspector Jules, inquiring after her. Wanted to know if she'd gotten back all right.
I'm fine.
The doctor nodded at the bag.
What have you got there?
The brigadier passed it to him.
Bit of evidence. A crushed syringe found at the eldest victim's murder site. One of the two nurses.
The doctor opened the bag and looked inside at the sticky fragments of glass, plastic, and metal.
Why wasn't I notified of this?
Well, it's in those reports.
Where? Page 253? Do you know how many reports I've still got left to read? Not to mention running about with you and testing the other samples.
All right, all right. Scotland Yard ran its own tests and found nothing unusual about the contents. But they thought they would pass it on to you, to be sure.
What were the contents? Looks like somebody stepped on it and made a proper job of it.
Yes, in the struggle. It contained the remains of a commercial preparation of Yoimbi. It tested true.
Yoimbi?
The brigadier shot a glance at the shelves to make sure that Joe was out of earshot. She had retreated back inside the storage room. He lowered his voice.
Enhances male performance.
Performance of what? Oh, easily available.
This brand is normally by prescription.
And how do you know so much about this?
The brigadier actually blushed.
I asked, in the interest of the investigation.
The doctor glanced at the bag.
Still, it does make you wonder how the pharmaceutical companies tested this for market.
He opened the bag and sniffed, then shook his head at the lack of viable residue.
I suppose the guinea pigs are still smiling.
Do you know anything about Yoimbi? Can it affect the psychology of a person using it?
No, it works more in terms of blood capillaries, circulation. It's an aphrodisiac almost by accident. I don't think it works like a testosterone injection would. That sort of substance, testosterone or a similar hormone, could actually affect a man's moods and emotional stability if taken in high enough dosage. But I'll look into this anyway. Make sure that nothing was bound into the chemical substance.
He glanced furtively at the storage room door. Joe had not come out, waiting until the brigadier left.
Look, let's go up to your office. We need to talk privately.
The doctor called back to the storeroom.
Joe, will you see to that list?
Yes, doctor.
Are you going to follow up with that inspector?
Yes, if it's all right.
What's she doing back there?
She's busy. We'll discuss it upstairs.
The doctor unslung his cape from his shoulders and hung it up on the coat rack as they exited the lab. It was nearly 5 before Joe was able to get back to Inspector Jules. Hunting down the prescriptions had taken a good deal of time, and even after several hours, she was still waiting for a few callbacks. Jules' office at the police station was an incredible clutter. Papers and file folders everywhere, piled up on the desk, piled on hard chairs. There were even piles of papers here and there on the floors. Jules himself was startled at her return, and as she was ushered into the cluttered office, he hastily ran his hand through his unkempt brown and gray hair and gave a self-conscious tug at his cheap gabardine suit coat. But his eyes lighted up at sight of her.
Miss Grant, what a pleasant surprise. You're looking much better than you were this morning, I must say.
Actually, she still looked pretty horrible, she thought. She accepted a seat in the office's one uncluttered chair.
I was wondering, could you tell me about Jack the Ripper-type murderers?
Sociopaths, you mean? Serial killers? Well, that doesn't seem to be what we're dealing with here.
As she said nothing one way or the other, he gave a nod.
Right, well, going by statistics, serial killers tend to be male, tend to prey sexually on their victims, which we don't have in these cases, and tend to be motivated by a deep hatred and desire for revenge against a single person or entity, or else are addicted to the sense of power that the crime gives them.
He paused and considered.
Yet there have been female serial killers, there have been serial killers who did not sexually assault victims, and there have been serial killers who should have been happy, optimistic people, yet resorted to killing anyway.
But are their cases consistent? I mean, for a given killer, he uses the same method over and over again, right?
Very often, not always.
He glanced at her with an approving look.
For some, it's a matter of finding what works and then sticking with it. For others, it's almost a ritual. They have to complete certain steps with the victim before completing the crime.
Each killer uses the same type of weapon again and again?
Almost always. Ropes and knives figure quite a bit, but there are the bludgeon fanciers, the stranglers, and those who use guns. But very often one specific killer will use one specific type of weapon again and again. Even if it's not the same knife for each victim, he'll always use a knife. Maybe not the same hammer, but always some hammer, like that. Not always. Some find a thrill in killing in a variety of ways, but generally the police can find trademark indications of a certain killer.
She was thoughtful.
I'll make tea. Would you like some?
Yes, thank you.
He went out for water and soon returned with the tea kettle.
Women are never serial killers?
He plugged in the kettle and rummaged through the vast piles of clutter for sugar and tea bags.
Well, that's the question, Miss Grant.
Unable to find the sugar and tea bags, he stepped back, puzzled. Then, on sudden inspiration, he started rummaging through desk drawers.
We have to know there's been murder done. What we're finding now are certain patterns of woman-originated serial killings, but they are very different, much harder to identify.
Why is that?
Triumphant, he pulled two withered-looking tea bags from a desk drawer and smiled at her, his dark eyes alight. He went to a tall cabinet to search for cups.
Women who kill habitually are subtle killers. Men like to gloat. They like to feel powerful. The male killer typically wants the victim to know and fear him. A woman usually is more practical. She takes her satisfaction from the fact that the victim can no longer abuse, control, infringe upon her. She gloats after the fact, if she gloats at all.
He pulled two cups from the cabinet, then he shot a glance at her.
You see, some women serial killers kill their babies. It gets attributed to crib death and the like, or they kill successive husbands to get the money, or perhaps even the sympathy. Sometimes they kill to get a certain vindication, but usually the crimes of a woman killer are more subtle.
He set the items up for tea and turned to her.
I'm not saying a woman couldn't torture a victim to death or couldn't be sexually aroused by exerting utter control over a victim, but it tends to be that male serial killers want to see and women serial killers want to know, but both are after a type of power or control. Nothing applies across the board, but those are the general rules.
It's like different psychologies between men and women.
Men and women do think and perceive things in different ways. We have very different brains as well as very different physiques.
By now, the tea kettle was hissing steam. He unplugged it and poured the water.
What are you thinking?
You know, if you were to look at the men as the weapons, then it is a serial killer at work. He's just using men as weapons, but it's nearly the same method each time.
Interesting perspective.
He carried the mugs to the desk and set hers down in a bare patch among the papers. He went around the desk to his chair and sat down with a sigh of thankfulness to be off his feet. He ran his fingers through his hair and looked thoughtful.
And it could be that the women are actually the weapons.
She knew this was an odd theory, but she forced herself to sound certain.
What?
Maybe the motive is not to kill women, but to ruin men. To make them suffer through the rest of their lives. That would be a crime, you know, more subtle. A crime where the thrill is knowing rather than seeing.
He leaned back and produced a pipe from his coat pocket. She nodded as he gestured at it to ask for permission to smoke. He lit it and puffed thoughtfully for a few moments.
What you're saying is possible, Miss Grant, but we have no more evidence of that hypothesis than we do of solar flares causing it, or something in the water, or a nervous disorder, or anything else.
Except two of the men and their victims visited the Women's Health Center on the days of the murders.
Yes, we know about that. I'm supposed to go out there first thing in the morning to interview Dr. Rosalind Mays.
He puffed thoughtfully at his pipe and looked at her with his almost doe-like eyes. He suddenly became offhand.
Care to go with me?
Love to. It was nearly 7 when Joe returned to the lab at Unit HQ. She'd stopped to purchase some expensive pancake-type makeup, which she had applied as soon as possible. It didn't quite hide everything, but it hid a lot. She no longer felt like a walking advertisement for aid to women. Unexpectedly, the Brigadier was waiting for her in the lab. The doctor stood by the TARDIS as though he were examining something. He had his back to her.
Miss Grant.
The Brigadier stepped forward, hands behind his back.
You've been hurt, I see.
I'm all right, sir.
Well, that's as may be, but I'm putting you on medical leave. Full pay and all that, but I want you off duty immediately.
Whatever for, I'm fine. The doctor turned and came forward, obviously uncomfortable. She instantly turned to him for support.
Doctor!
Joe, the Brigadier's right. Off you go.
You're both in on this.
Miss Grant, you are no longer a junior member of this organization. I expect you to take orders with the promptness and bearing of a seasoned professional.
You would never do this to a seasoned professional. She caught herself just short of exclaiming that it wasn't fair. The order is arbitrary and ill-considered. The doctor came up to her and put his hands on her shoulders. He met her eye.
We can't have you go with us into the heart of this thing. We can't.
I'll keep a guard with me.
A male guard against a male attacker, Joe? How do we know they wouldn't both turn on you? I can't stay with you every moment. For that matter, if there is a malice behind all this, it could turn anybody here at Unit against you. It would surely thwart us that way.
He rested his hand on her head, an effort at conciliation. You, dead, and one of our own, the killer. We can't allow it.
You're frightened.
Yes, losing you so horribly frightens me.
His tone shamed her. Part of her knew that they were acting out of genuine affection for her, genuine fear for her safety, but part of her could not endure the suddenness, the arbitrary nature of the decision.
Joe, if any man at any time can attack any woman, then it will get more dangerous for all of us as we investigate further.
I don't mind the danger.
He shook his head. There are the men to consider as well.
If the men here fall under the influence of this thing, then any woman is in danger. Why should I be exempted?
The doctor shook his head again, refusing to be drawn into the argument.
Your contributions in this case have been incredibly valuable. When all is said and done, you'll be recognized for the part you've played.
Oh, stop it. The Brigadier held out a hand, palm up.
Your passes and papers will stay here, Miss Grant. I will contact you as soon as I have determined that you should return to duty.
She had been too angry to cry, but as she passed her unit access cards and keys to him, her hand shook. The Brigadier took them, his eyes down.
Joe, this is not a disciplinary action. We're proud of you. I'm proud of you. But we cannot adequately protect you.
I'll escort you to your car.
The doctor turned to him.
I will.
He looked at her.
I'll take you to dinner.
I don't want to go to dinner.
I must ask you to hand over your briefcase and notebook as well.
She did. She wouldn't look at the doctor as the Brigadier led her out.
Joe, I'm sorry.
But she didn't answer him.